Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and live from a frigid Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where the temperature is going to drop to, oh my God, 23 degrees tonight. This is Dr. John Stamey welcoming you to another bang-up episode of Scary Cast. Absolutely the best paranormal show on the internet, for sure. And on WLSC AM and FM, the overnight midnight show on Saturday night. That means we're officially a paranormal show. Anyway, it's good to have everybody here. We got almost everybody here. Well, everybody that's going to be on here is with us tonight. I want to introduce, first of all, my co-hosts. I've got some of the best ones. As I said, first of all, the man that's been with me the longest, he's been here since ScaryCast started and changed our format to this in January about 5 years ago, the one and only Devin Tate from West Hollywood. How you doing tonight, buddy?
I'm doing great. I almost hate to tell you it was 70 degrees here today, so we had a nice sunny afternoon, but I didn't really get to go outside, so we are unfortunately having a COVID surge, though, at the moment, so I had a Bowie night I was supposed to be playing at on Sunday at the Hotel Cafe in Hollywood, and it just got postponed for a month, so things are pretty good here. A little bummed about that, but hey, it gives me more time to practice, so.
Well, that's good, and yeah, I know it'll be a great show when you get it done, so glad to have you here. And our Surgeon General of ScaryCast, the one and only Dr. Trey Donaway, who has a new profession now as a professional furniture mover. How are you doing, Dr. Trey? Are you there, Dr. Trey? We'll come back to him. And from Canada, and I know it's cold up there in Canada with Niagara Falls, the one and only Mark Johnston from Niagara Falls, Canada. How are you doing tonight, buddy?
Hey, John. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm cold. I'm happy to be here with my buddies from ScaryCast. And now I'm going to tell everybody that you just sent me two of the most amazing paranormal pictures I have ever seen. It shows a full manifestation of a fist. And there are two of them. They're a little bit different. So that means, I mean, it took a ton of energy for whatever that was to manifest that fist, F-I-S-T, fist. So I tell you what, we're gonna look at that, and hopefully we can get your friend whose house this manifestation came in, get him on the show in a couple of weeks. So
if we have some time on today's podcast, I'll tell you all about that. I'll fill you in on what he had to say about it. And yeah, but I'm looking forward to today's show and our guest tonight and hear what he has to say about his experiences.
Absolutely. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll sneak around while we're on, and I'll post one of those pictures on the ScaryCast Facebook page. So if we can hold your commentary till the end of the show, then I'll have it posted so everybody can see it. Is that okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, good. And is Dr. Trey Donaway in the house? Well, Dr. Trey, we're not able to hear you. I'll send you a text and ask you to call back in. So anyway, tonight, from the center of Virginia, we have what I would call a true paranormalist. He is a curator for a historic building that is operational. He runs a huge expo, paranormal expo, and he's a ghost hunter. I mean, he just does it all. He does everything but cook the spaghetti. Here is tonight our guest, Steve Dills. Steve, how are you doing tonight?
I'm pretty good. How are you guys doing? Thank you for having me on.
Oh, we're glad to have you on here, buddy. I'm going to tell you that. You're an exciting commodity for ScaryCast. You just do it all. I mean, this is like when we had our sorcerer on. He does it all. He casts spells. He educates. And he's a psychic. I mean, and I spent the weekend with him. I mean, that was great. I mean, you know, can you imagine the psychic and a medium sitting there with a sorcerer eating barbecue and talking about Lucifer and Satan and all this stuff, and everybody's just looking at us. And I finally said, don't talk so loud. They'll kick us out of here. It was hysterical. No, it was the best. And Jason McClendon, he was with us. He was there with me. It was truly the most fun I've had in a long, long time, saying, be quiet. Don't talk so much about Satan here in the barbecue restaurant. The place was full, and all the old couples just listening. Oh, my God. They're talking about Satan and Lucifer. Oh, anyway, it was funny. All right, so now, I guess here's my first good. I'm glad we all had a good laugh. So now, here is, if I'm not mistaken, Dr. Trey Donaway is trying to call back in again. Let's just, Dr.
John,
Trey Donaway, how are you doing tonight?
Good, John. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now,
John?
And it's perfect. Yeah, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
I switched you from headphone to regular handheld to speaker, and I don't know. I shut down the phone and started it up. So I guess maybe my phone is haunted.
Well, we're glad to have our Surgeon General, and I just introduced Steve.
But if it's
Steve
haunted,
Dill.
we've got the person to hunt it out.
We do. I'm going to tell you that. So anyway, glad to have you here on this cold night in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And now, Steve, I've given everybody a quick overview of what you do, but tell us a little bit about this tavern that you run. This is fascinating, and you're like the guy that runs it, correct?
Sort of. So my real job, by day, I work in IT, actually. And I am the current president of the foundation that owns and operates the Hanover Tavern. So I am the guy that is kind of over the board of directors. And we have a staff that report to the board of directors. So there's a few of us that I guess technically say we quote unquote run or operate the tavern, but it is definitely a place that I have spent countless hours, to anger my wife because I'm up there so often. but it's a blast. It is a very neat location.
Well, that's great.
Steve, this is Trey. Where in Hanover? Hanover, is that the name of the town as well, or where is your tavern located?
It's a county, so we are located in Hanover County, Virginia, which is just probably 15, 20 minutes north of Richmond, and we're actually in the county of Hanover as opposed to a town, because the Hanover Tavern actually sits in what is known as a county complex. And so being a tavern, it wouldn't have just stood on its own. It would have had some importance or reason to be there, whether it was just a stop on the stagecoach road at the time. But in our case, the Hanover Tavern is actually, it was built to serve the purpose of the historic courthouse that's right across the street. So we've got not only the Hanover Tavern there, but right across the street is an historic courthouse, the third oldest in the country, as well as an old stone jail, the clerk of court building, and a few other kind of smaller outbuildings.
Is it far from Goochland?
It's not too far. It's not too far at all.
Okay. I know exactly where Goochland is, so, and I know I must have passed buy it on 95. Okay, now I'm secure. So this was a tavern built when-ish?
So the original tavern dates back to 1733. We know this because we found records, and that's the first date that a tavern was licensed to operate on the grounds that the Hanover Tavern currently sits. So 1733 is when we know the first tavern opened. Our current building dates back to 1791 and 1821. That was when the two biggest portions of the building were built. So the original tavern And there's a lot of history and a lot of notable figures that are tied to the original tavern, as well as the what we call the new tavern. But the original tavern stood for just shy of 100 years before the tavern owners at that time decided that they wanted to expand, build a bigger tavern. And so in 1791, they built a home, and then 1821, they built what is called the new tavern.
Gotcha. Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt. I just wanted a little historical background. Thank you.
Great. I love talking about it, so I am all for it.
And so that you know and so that everybody knows, Trey Donaway has been very instrumental in historical artifacts, buildings, and programs in Camden, South Carolina, which is South Carolina's oldest inland city. And Trey, if I'm not mistaken, it is the second oldest city, period, in South Carolina, just after Charleston. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, you had areas around in the Lowcountry, but in the Midlands, it probably is one of the very oldest places you're going to run into.
That's awesome.
Right, and I can tell everybody there's a gigantic field. It was the site of a fort, and Trey, now correct me if I'm wrong, but it was the site of a fort slash town that the British burned and destroyed in the Revolutionary War. Is that correct?
Well, Camden was the economic and cultural center of the backcountry of the Carolinas, both North and South Carolina. And it was occupied by the British in the Revolution and then finally abandoned. And the British, of course, burned it on the way out of town, but that's our history. But I want to hear about your tavern, Stephen.
No, I was just trying to let everyone know that Trey is really kind of, he's definitely an expert in history of that time, and that's why it's good to have him. So anyway, now we've
that's
kind
awesome.
Of established how long the tavern has been around. And has it just been a drinking hall ever since the new tavern was built in 1821?
It has not. So the original tavern, and keep in mind there were a number of different owners throughout the years. So it actually wasn't always known as the Hanover Tavern. It had a few different names and a few different kind of lives, if you will. The most notable was. The tavern was obviously a tavern for the longest period of time so far. It was a stop on the Stagecoach Road, and we had tons of different folks from George Washington to Rochambeau, even P.T. Barnum, and most likely Edgar Allan Poe would have stopped by and graced the halls. But as most old buildings do, it ended up kind of being set to the wayside for a period of time. And it had become fairly dilapidated until in the 1950s, a group known as the Barksdale Theater Troupe from New York came down to Virginia, and they were looking to find a location that could serve as a place to perform for theatrical performances. They found the Hanover Tavern, and they decided this is where we want to do this. And so they moved in, and not only did they live in the tavern, but they also converted the basement. They dug it out, and they turned it into a theater. So the Hanover Tavern kind of changed pretty drastically. It went from just a tavern where you would go and you would, you know, drink, eat. More often than not, it would be after circuit court was in session, right? It was also a post office. But during the Barksdale Theater period, it was the first actual dinner and a show. It was the very first theater that you would be able to go and get dinner, and then immediately after, go to a theatrical performance. So you've got the Barksdale Theater era. During that time, it was a home. It was a hotel, a boutique hotel. It was apartments for a brief period of time. And then pretty much anything and everything they could try to keep the building afloat. I mean, it's a pretty big building, and as you guys probably know, keeping historical buildings alive is very, very difficult. The restoration and preservation is extremely expensive. And so in 1990, after some debate as to what to do with the tavern, the originators from the Barksdale period, when they came down, were getting old, and they decided they didn't want to do this anymore. They grew tired of taking care of a historical building. So they decided to help form a foundation, the Hanover Tavern Foundation. Essentially, they sold the tavern to the Hanover Tavern Foundation in 1990, and that is when the nonprofit that I am, the president of today, began renovating and restoring the building. And so today we've got, a museum, right? We're a historic location, but we also have a theater, and Barksdale Theater still actually performs there. It's under a different name, but they're still there. We've got a restaurant, a full grill and bar. We do historical interpretation, and we also have field trips, so we have students coming through and all that sort of fun stuff every year. And we do a lot of community outreach. We try to do as much as we can to support and uphold the community. So it has lived very, very different lives over its entire course.
That sounds great. That sounds great. I think a lot of people, I know we restored a building to be interpreted as a tavern in Camden through Historic Camden. I was chairman of that for a while. And, we got pushback from some of the city councilmen that didn't understand. They said, why are you asking us to give money to promote drinking? And we had explained, well, a tavern was it was a public house. Yes, you could get something to drink, to eat, to sleep. That's where you'd get mail. This is where your information would spread from. And at one time, Camden had 20-some-odd taverns, and some of them still never did get it. But what you're doing is wonderful work. And it is very difficult, and it's difficult to keep the thing up and going. But it sounds like you've got different avenues to do that.
Oh, yeah. And like you said, the tavern, when you think of a tavern today, you think of somewhere you're going to go and grab a drink and maybe some, really junky bar food. Like you said, that's not the case. This was essentially a community center before community centers or hubs were a thing. This is where if you needed a place to stay, if you needed to, if you're riding on the road, right, and you needed somewhere to just stop and take a breather, you'd be stopping on the Stagecoach Road at different taverns as you went up. It's not just a place to get a drink.
Before churches were built, you might have Sunday services there because, again, it was a large indoor space in a colonial era where there weren't lots of large indoor spaces. So it really was a very multifunctional, as you put it, community center.
Yep. For ours, one of my favorite, I suppose, claims to fame is the Hanover Tavern was actually owned by the Shelton family for a period of time. And the Sheltons had a daughter by the name of Sarah, whom a fairly decently known historical figure by the name of Patrick Henry ended up marrying. And
I've heard of that
Patrick
guy.
Henry.
Is that weird? Okay.
One of those, sounds familiar, right? So Patrick Henry and Sarah actually lived at the tavern for a period of time, and he was a bar boy at the tavern. He actually played the fiddle to entertain guests while they were there, but it's actually, we surmise, at the tavern that he found his love for law, because after circuit court, all of the lawyers, any judge, literally anybody and everybody would walk across the street and grab some food, grab something to drink, et cetera. Maybe they're staying the night there because, it's circuit court in one county, so you're going to travel a little bit. And so it's at the tavern that they had a lot of these business discussions and meetings where he was able to pick it up enough that he found interest in it. And so if we didn't have something as simplistic as that, where it's not just drinking, it's actually like a fairly important location in a community at that point, we may not have had the revolution. So,
yeah, I think it was Patrick Henry. Isn't he the guy that said, give me a decent tip or expect really slow service?
That's exactly verbatim.
I thought so. I think he adapted it later on during the revolution, but I think that was the original quote.
And, you know, he actually, when he started practicing law, Parsons' cause, taxation without representation, he argued that case at the historic courthouse, the Hanover County Courthouse, across the street. So we've got a young Patrick finding his passion for law. And then just a little bit later, he is yet again here in Hanover County, right across the street, where he is literally one of the sparks of the American Revolution. And then, of course,
when you can put a historic individual right there in the tavern. So do you have any Patrick Henry drinks or libations or food products that you've labeled on your menu?
Oh, we do. Yeah. So we our bar, we work on trying to name our drinks after certain figures. And then some of our meals, some of it, it is what it is because it's easiest. But some of our, like, salads and soups and that sort of thing, as well as some of our drinks and mixes are named after Patrick Henry or Sarah or George Washington, just notable figures that have passed through, like you said.
Right. That's great.
Steve, this is just amazing. I cannot wait to come up there. And now tell everybody why I will be up there the weekend of the 22nd. Give us the full rundown of the amazing event that you're going to be hosting.
Sure. So on January 21st and 22nd, we are going to be hosting our very first Hanover Tavern Paracon. We were hoping that this would be the second one, but COVID kind of shut down the very first one. And so, you know, I know we're kind of in the midst of more COVID right now, but we're going to be very careful and just, you know, urge folks to wear masks and be safe. But we are going to be having the Hanover Tavern Paracon on January 21st and 22nd. We have a huge slew of folks that are going to be joining us. We've got about 20 speakers and special guests that are going to be there. And we're going to have a blast. It's going to be Saturday, January 22nd from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. And then we're going to have different speakers throughout the entire time. We're going to have a big gallery reading. We're going to have panels and discussions and all these sorts of things. After that, we are going to be having a dinner with the special guests and investigators. So, and I'll share all of the speakers and who they are, but essentially each person that you hear, so long as they don't have anything crazy and they have to head out of town, they're going to be hanging out with you at dinner that evening. And then immediately after dinner, we're going to investigate. So we're going to be investigating the Hanover Tavern, the Old Stone Jail across the street, the historic courthouse, and the Hanover Library, which is right there and actually built possibly on a graveyard. So we're going to be doing that on Saturday. And then actually Friday night before that, we are going to be having kind of a VIP event. We're calling it Friday Night Fright, and it's going to start with something called Macabre Tales from Hanover to Richmond. And that is going to be from 7 to 9. It's a three-course dinner that is hosted by Haunts of Richmond's Chris and Beth Houlihan. Haunts of Richmond is a tour company that is here in Richmond and totally unbiased. They host the best ghost tours of Richmond City. so it's a three-course dinner. They're going to share some tales from right in our own backyard, and then after that you're going to investigate with them as well as the Ghost Finders and the Sisterhood of Magic and Wonders. with my own team, Transcend Paranormal, and another team right here that works very closely with us called CPRI. So it's going to be fun. We've got a bunch of different folks that are going to be there. We've got the Ghost Finders, which is one of the longest-running TV shows for the paranormal. That is going to be Rob Thompson, who is a spirit medium, Megan Deputy, Melody Knapp, and myself. We're going to have the Sisterhood of Magic and Wonders, which is Misty and Ashley Connor, Pat O'Keefe, and Rhonda Caudell. We are going to have the Ghost Excavator, one of my favorite folks, John Sable. He is phenomenal. I love his work. He's one of my favorites. We're going to have Chris and Bill Reap from Reap Investigations, Carson Hudson, who just recently released a book on witchcraft in Virginia, in colonial Virginia, Alan Marston, the Haunted MD, Donald Molnar. We're going to have Chris Vaughn, who is actually one of my own team members, but part of, or actually hosts his podcast, Campfire Chronicles. Brad Bradley and Jack Trammell, who are both on CPRI, which is the Center for Paranormal Research and Investigation. And we're also going to have David Deal, who is our executive director at Hanover Tavern. So each of those folks is going to be speaking and sharing their wealth of knowledge and insight into the paranormal, preternatural, what have you. And we're going to have a blast. We're going to have a bunch of different vendors. I mean, it's going to be fun. Tavern's going to be open, so folks get to go inside and check it out a little bit. We're going to investigate. We're going to eat. You know, it's going to be a lot of fun. And 100% of the proceeds, everything, goes directly to the Hanover Tavern for its continued restoration and preservation, as well as the community and educational outreach that we do.
And that just sounds wonderful, Steve. It really does. And brand new news, the first time it's been announced, ScaryCast is going to be there. ScaryCast has a table, and I hope that we will be doing several mini or regular podcasts with your guests and really help chronicle what you're doing. I mean, I think this is phenomenal. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I really, really like. And I just think it's going to be great. So we're going to have I'll be up there and I'm going to be having a blast with you guys. What time do I need to be there at Friday night to get started with you guys? About 7:30 or so.
So if you're coming to the Friday night event, Friday night fright starts at around like 6:30 or so. We're going to have dinner from 7 to 9, and then the investigation. It's going to be a light investigation, but it's a lot less folks. So it's going to be much more intimate. You'll have a better opportunity to hang out with the Ghost Finders and the Sisterhood, and that's going to be from 9 to midnight. And then that gives you just enough time to get back to a hotel, fall asleep for 20 minutes, and then get back up because we're going to start the event. The whole conference starts at 11 a.m. the next day. So just enough time to say you took a nap.
Thanks for letting me know. I'll be there at 6 o'clock ready to go on Friday night. This sounds like the greatest thing. And I will announce officially the Alabama Paracon. You know, we're going to do another Paracon. Alabama Paracon is going to be April the 30th. And that's the same weekend as the Strawberry Festival in Coleman. And we don't care. I think we're going to have a whole different crowd for the Alabama Paracon. I don't think those people at that state park are going to be ready for the Paracon, but we're going to do it, and it's going to be a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to being at yours and learning what I can about how you run one, because I haven't run a Paracon in about 3 years. The last one I ran was the Charlotte CryptoCon, crypto as in cryptids. Mm-hmm. So it was a blast. I mean, I met some. You know, it was funny. I think I had the best time of everybody. We had about 200 people there. I had the best time because I met one of my favorite guest speakers. His name is Dr. Lynn Myers, Reverend Dr. Lynn Myers. He's a crazy man, but I love him. He's just so entertaining, and he's got some definite views. So, yeah, I think one reason that I like running my events, and Dr. Trey Donaway has been to one of my Comic-Cons, the one that I had in Canada. I just love it because of the people that I meet. That's what makes it fun, you know. There are all kinds of great people.
Oh, yeah.
I met him. I met Trey dressed up as a Revolutionary War soldier in front of a cannon of all things, and we started talking and we haven't stopped since. So, you know, you just, it's a matter of getting out there and meeting people and having a good time and part, yeah, it's important to me, but I think that's why, am I correct? That's why you do this is because don't you have fun running the tavern as the executive director and putting this on? I know it's work, but don't you think it's fun?
Oh, it's a blast. I mean, and it allows you to meet so many different folks and so many different walks of life. You know, when I'm doing work at the tavern, you know, not only am I doing, you know, the president, you know, behind the scenes work that I do, but occasionally I do get in front of folks and I'm able to get out in front of people and make connections. I will help out in our restaurant occasionally and I'll go down and bartend, and that gives me a really cool opportunity to meet people and chat with them. And then, you know, we always put on tons of different events, not just paranormal, but tons of different things. And it's a great way to meet folks. I will say that, you know, being in the paranormal and kind of, you know, meeting people who I've come to call family and friends now, it's been a great opportunity because it gives me new ways to look at the world. And also I get to build a really, really unique and supportive tribe, I would say, because every single one of the speakers for the Hanover Tavern Paracon, none of them are getting paid. They are all coming down of their own volition. They're coming, you know, to share their, you know, their insight, their knowledge, their gifts, and doing it for free. So, you know, it's awesome because I've been able to meet some like-minded people that are in it to support and raise awareness around historic restoration. And using the paranormal not only as a means to understand this unknown phenomena around us, but also to help restore and preserve historical sites. And they find that just as important as I do, which is awesome. So, you know, it's been great because not only are all of these speakers volunteering to come down and help out and be part of this, but all of the, you know, the vendors, everybody that has been chipping in, there are tons of different teams that have helped out along the way. RTL Paranormal, Spirit Guides Paranormal, Flumeri Promotions. There are so many different teams that have chipped in and offered to help. And, you know, even just buying a vending table helps. Buying a general admission ticket helps, because for most historical sites, and this is something a lot of people don't realize, they don't get federal, state, or any sort of local funding, no support. Everything that, especially I can tell you that for the tavern, everything that we do is through grants and donations and people coming to join us for events. And that's how we're able to stay afloat.
Well, that's great. And by the way, I'm going to take this important moment to make a 10-second station break and say thanks to WLSC AM and FM Loris Myrtle Beach for carrying ScaryCast, your overnight paranormal show on midnight on Banana Jack's radio station. We love Banana Jack. He's such a great supporter of ScaryCast, and just glad to be friends with him. So anyway, thanks, WLSC AM and FM Loris Myrtle Beach. And anyway, now we're back to ScaryCast. And you did a perfect job, Steve, because what you did was you encapsulated not only the tavern, the history of the tavern, and the event in 30 minutes. So now comes part two of our show. Not only are you a tavern manager, we'll call you a tavern manager, not only do you run expos, I've run them enough, and I know exactly what you're going through, but you're also what I would call a general paranormalist, which means you hunt for ghosts. So part two of our interview with you, starting right now, tell us a little bit about this. And by the way, now that we're going to talk about your ghost hunting knowledge, expertise, and adventures. It's time for Mark and Devin and Dr. Trey to join in, ask questions. You know, whenever you got them, just come on right in, because I'm sure Steve won't mind some questions, will you?
No, throw them at me. I'm totally okay with that.
Well, that's good.
Tell us about your paranormal experiences at the tavern and what you found and what you hope to discover.
I was just going to ask the same thing, Trey.
So the tavern, like I've alluded to, is a pretty unique place. We have a pretty decent length of history, not as in-depth as some of the other locations that I've investigated, but the tavern has stood for quite some time and been a very important historical location for a fair amount of things, including the American Revolution and the Civil War. So keeping that in mind, we have a very big width of years, I guess, a very big timeline that when we're going into the Hanover Tavern and we're investigating what we potentially could come in contact with. We have interacted with spirits, entities, whatever you want to call them, that are more likely to interact with us when we ask questions regarding the Civil War or the war between the states. We have some that are more likely to interact with us when we talk more about knowing who Patrick Henry is, not necessarily Patrick Henry himself, but who Patrick Henry is, or, you know, what he was doing there with the Shelton family, right? We also have spirits there that claim that they're actors and actresses. So we have, a whole slew of things that we could be interacting with. I will say even recently we've interacted with something that we call Doppelganger Dave, and that was coined from one of my teammates, Tiffany, so major props to Tiff. But Doppelganger Dave is this spirit or entity that for whatever reason likes to imitate our executive director, Dave, so much so that we have visibly seen this entity as Dave, our executive director, standing at the end of a hallway, and when we go to approach him, he disappears, and it's a Sunday, and it's at 2 a.m. in the morning, and Dave is at home in bed. we've run through the whole gamut in terms of timeline. In terms of what we've actually encountered, again, it's a smorgasbord. Like, we're, constantly hearing tons of AVP, so audible voice phenomena, hearing people talking throughout the tavern, hearing people walking, whistles. We've got doors opening and closing. We have them interacting with us via turning on candles. Now, like electric candles, we don't allow open flames in the tavern because it's old and it would go up like a tinderbox. But actually having these electric candles where you have to press a button on the bottom of them, they're sitting in a candle holder, and all of a sudden they start turning on one after the other in the room by themselves. Shadow figures, smells, like phantom smells, mostly of cigars and perfumes, and that's typically up in the bedroom area, so the second floor of the tavern. But, I mean, we have run just about into just about everything that you could experience in terms of, like, when you're talking about the preternatural from a ghostly point of view, we've probably had it happen there at one point or the other.
And Steve, have you personally encountered any of these experiences? Could you describe some of those things if you have?
Sure. Yeah. So one of my favorites the very first encounter was not mine for this particular spirit. However, it is the reason that my team was brought in. And so just to cover it very briefly, I founded, myself and a few others founded a team called Transcend Paranormal in 2010. We started working with a place called Henricus Historical Park, which is the second oldest English settlement in America. They saw us doing fundraising down there, and the Hanover Tavern reached out because they said, hey, what's that paranormal team that's working with you guys? And it was us. So I got a phone call from David, actually the executive director, still today. And he was talking about some experiences that he didn't have, but his wife and daughter had. And so he recounts to me this story that they're serving tea. They have, you know, we have tea events up there where, you know, on Sunday afternoons, we host these big tea events and, you know, folks come and have tea and pastries and all that sort of fun stuff. And it was up in one of our historic rooms. So they're up there serving, you know, working the event. And their daughter, Katie, is sitting on one of the steps to one of the other historic rooms, the parlor. Patty, his wife, is standing there in the hallway, and all of a sudden she feels somebody grab her on her shoulder. So she turns around, assuming that maybe it's a guest that needs help or is, like, about to fall or something like that, because it was a pretty aggressive grab. She turns around, and nobody is there, and the closest person is Katie, who is sitting on a step, you know, a couple feet away. So not, you know, not within arm's reach. So she turns around. She's about to ask Katie, what's going on? You know, why did you grab me? And then one of the servers for the event says, hey, we need more tea. So she brushes it off and she says, Katie, I need you to get more tea for the guests. Katie stands up, and as she turns and walks into the parlor, she makes eye contact with a woman in a black morning gown. A Victorian black morning gown. And this woman looks her in the eyes, smiles, turns around, and exits the room. And as she's exiting the room via the other doorway on the other side of the room, she disappears right as she hits the threshold. And so that is the story of Our Lady in Black. And I feel like every historical site has, like, a Lady in White or a Lady in Black or something like that. But that is our own Lady in Black. And so for years, we had always wondered, who was this lady in black? Like, why is she here? What is she doing? Because we hadn't been able to make contact with her. When we went in to investigate, that was the very first thing we tried to do, was we sat down in the parlor and we're like, hey, can you talk to us? Can you help us understand why you're here? We start finally doing, you know, some really deep diving and research into the tavern and its early inhabitants. And it turns out that during the Victorian era, actually during the Civil War and then immediately after, one of the tavern owners lost two of their daughters while they were living there at the tavern to one of the sicknesses that was going around. I can't remember if it was diphtheria or yellow fever, but it was one of the two that both of these daughters had died from. They both die, and one of them has two children that, you know, inevitably her parents have to take care of. So we read that, and kind of like immediately it clicks, right? You've got this woman in a black Victorian-era dress, a mourning gown, and if you know anything about mourning practices at that time, it was very commonplace, depending on the relationship with the deceased, how long a woman would be wearing all black. And it was Victorian. So that makes sense.
Steve, wasn't that approximately 1 year back in those days that they would wear a morning gown, like a black morning gown?
It may have been. But I don't know – what I don't know or don't recall is approximately how long between the two deaths were. And keep in mind that she also had two sons and a slew of relatives in the area that were all off at war. So there is a it could have been 1 year. It really depended on your relationship to the deceased, if it was a child, like your child, if it was your husband, if it was a parent, et cetera. But she was, I mean, she was, you know, presenting herself in this outfit, right? The other thing that was interesting is that she was doing so in the parlor. And the parlor was important because this was part of the home portion of the tavern, not the tavern. It was the home of the tavern owners. So guests of the tavern would not have been in there. It would have been reserved for family members, the family itself, and highly esteemed guests, right? So, you know, you put all this together, and the fact that the parlor would have been where any viewing would have been done, and we're pretty sure we know who Our Lady in Black is now. Fast forward, and we're able to get a name, and actually, as of recently, we've been able to interact with her. We've been able to get her communicating with us via EVP, which is electronic voice phenomena. We've been able to get her to interact via turning on and off equipment, and we've also had a number of psychics come in and pick up the same exact information, and this isn't very well published anywhere. You have to do some serious digging for it, but they've been able to validate that same thing as this is what we're picking up to, this is what, you know, the information that we have. And to me, that is one of the coolest things, is when I can take an experience that is purely paranormal, has no, you know, seat in history, and I can tie it to an actual historical event and make it fit, unbiasedly fit, with all of the information making sense. So that's one of my stories. There's tons of things that go on there, but that's always been my favorite.
That's a really great
now,
story.
But,
I mean,
and you said this.
Yes, Trey.
You said
go
this was not witnessed by you, but what have you witnessed?
So, in terms of what I have witnessed, I have, you know, the things that I've seen in there aren't as story bound, and are still things that I'm trying to figure out, and how they make sense and fit into the context of the building. Up on the second floor, I was giving a tour one evening. We do historical tours and paranormal tours, so of course I was doing a paranormal tour. And I was standing at an intersection on the second floor where a number of bedrooms meet. For whatever reason, this location in particular has a really heavy feeling in the air. It's also where we pick up the most prominent floral and cigar scents. So I'm standing there giving this tour, and behind me, so keep in mind, so this hallway is like a T, right? So you walk down this long hallway, and you dead end, and you can either go right or left. I am standing in the middle of that intersection, and the guests are still along that long hallway. I'm talking and recounting, you know, some experiences, and all of a sudden, the guests that are standing in front of me say they saw a 4-foot shadow figure, like, walk directly behind me. Now, when I say shadow figure, I don't mean something that was projecting on the wall. I'm talking about a full-bodied, you know, apparition, but jet black, just walk right behind me. And so I'm like, okay, well, you know, that happens here. You know, I'm going to continue to tell the story because I can talk until the cows come home. I continue to talk, and then they stop and start staring behind me again because they said that they watched this wispy thing, almost like they could explain it like a butterfly almost, but pretty big, like a basketball, floating, again, about 4 feet off the ground, and it went in the opposite direction from whatever this figure. If the figure walked from right to left, it went from left to right. And so I'm like, okay, now, you know, now I, like, why are you guys seeing this and not me? So I'm like, all right, everybody into the hallway. Like, I'm going to stand in the hallway with you guys because I want to be able to see this stuff. So as we're standing there, again, I'm starting into another story, and one of the guests is standing in the middle of the hallway. She goes to lean against the wall. And as she does that, I watch this white figure, like the opposite of a shadow figure, full white, dart out from behind her, probably about 5 feet in height, dart out behind her and run down the long hallway that we just walked from. And I'm like, I stopped dead in my tracks at that point because I'm like, all right, did I just see that or am I going insane? So I ask the guest, I say, I need you to, like, this is going to sound weird, but I need you to, like, turn around in a circle for me. Because I wanted to make sure, like, she didn't have, like, a white coat that she was holding on to or a purse or something, and maybe, like, I mistook something. Nope. Nothing there. So, you know, I'm looking down the hallway, and then we start hearing footsteps down there. So, of course, the tour ends, and now we're walking down the hallway to figure out what's going on. And, of course, nobody's down there. But it was quite interesting, and that was, like, one of the most prominent full-body figures that I've seen there, just because of all of the activity going on within a five-minute window. I've seen full-body apparitions, especially in the theater, shadow figures in the theater, which is in the basement. We get that pretty often. We will have tons of shadow figures. If you're sitting on the stage, you'll see tons of shadow play through there. We will have balls, like if you bring a ball, like a toy, one of the spirits in there will roll it back to you. We've actually had a ball roll back and forth on the stage for us. Just all sorts of things in there, especially in the theater.
When you do your investigation, Stephen, what do you use, divining rods, or do you lose electronic monitor? How do you do your investigations?
It depends. Typically, we lend more to scientific equipment, so electronic equipment. We do have some folks that use divining rods, I can't say that there's one right way to investigate the paranormal, so I won't say that, they're bad to use. I couldn't tell you one way or the other, but I'm more of like a data-driven kind of person. So when we're investigating, we typically try to use, camcorders. We've got a number of camcorders that can film in zero lux, and that way we can get a good visual representation of what's going on around us. We use a lot of audio recorders, mostly Zoom, and that gives us some really good omnidirectional audio recording. And then in terms of some of the equipment, a lot of it is data loggers. We use a lot of EMF, electromagnetic field detectors, and data loggers for that. We're looking at things like temperature, barometric pressure, just tons of different things. We're looking at static electricity buildup in the air, any of that sort of stuff. And then of course, you've got your blinky light things, is what I like to call them, where it's, you know, people using flashlights, you know, can you turn the flashlight on and off, all that sort of stuff. But typically, when we're looking at paranormal, you know, phenomena, something that's actually occurring, we're trying our best to align that and correlate that with some sort of data point. And we've seen some really cool data come out of that. For example, one of the things that one of the teams we work with, CPRI, is noticing, and we're actually seeing it as well, is when there is a paranormal experience that has occurred, they're seeing a spike in radioactive energy, right? So it might be immediately before, during, or after, but they're seeing a radioactive spike right in localized in that area, that is correlating with a paranormal experience, whether that's hearing something, seeing something, feeling something. And so we've been able to take what they're finding and almost recreate it in a sense, because we're deploying dosimeters and finding heightened radioactivity, and then bam, a paranormal experience occurs, whether it's recording an EVP or what have you. Then it immediately drops again. So we're trying to use a mix of equipment, in the past it was always scientific, but we're trying to correlate scientific with metaphysical experiences now as well.
You know, I'm not a ghost hunter. I don't know anything about it, but I don't think I've ever heard anyone using a dosimeter or a radio, radioactive detector, a Geiger counter, whatever the equipment you use for paranormal. So is that in the usual armamentarium, or is this a little bit different?
It's a little bit different. It's not. It's definitely not normal. Most of the teams that you see today are going to be utilizing things like EDI plus data loggers, or you know, just your basic EMF or static electricity detectors. There's a lot of teams, however, that have started looking into something very similar. I will say we picked this idea up from CPRI, and we wanted to continue their research. And they're still actively researching. There's no conclusive data yet, but it is quite interesting to see that correlation. We're also seeing the same thing with barometric pressure drops. We will see, you know, either some sort of radioactive spike, or we'll see a change in barometric pressure that correlates with some preternatural phenomena.
Steve,
it's fascinating that it would have a radioactive spike and then it would go away. That's really curious.
Well, and you know, Steve, I wanted to make an a little bit of a 2-minute observation here. Being a guy that with a doctorate from North Carolina State University in computer science, I am probably one of the most quantitative men that you will ever meet. And I do not believe that quantitative work will exactly give you what you're looking for when it comes to the paranormal. Here is an example. I've got two examples that I want to tell everybody about. Number one, copper divining rods. Are you familiar with copper divining rods, Steve?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we've got some folks that use them.
Uh-huh. That's right. Well, I use them, too. And I've used them very successfully in a private residence that has uncovered exactly what the people who lived there said. The lady said, I'm scared of this room. After I went through there and my copper divining rod started spinning around, she said, I'm scared of this room. I said, okay, great. So we had a direct hit. And a family member of that house had a direct hit in the same areas that I did. Yet her parents couldn't get a hit with divining rods, okay? Number one. Number two, as I said earlier on, and Trey, you probably didn't hear this, but I hung out with my buddy the sorcerer this weekend, and he had a statue of Saint Cyp, you know, Jason McClendon from Cullman, Alabama. I hung out with him in Shelby, North Carolina. He works for Walmart, and he's up there trying to direct people and trying to fix their supply chain stuff. They've got problems. So, you know, I brought him his Christmas present late, which was some copper divining rods. And it turns out he had a statue of Saint Cyprian, who's the patron saint. He is a saint through the Catholic Church. And he's the patron saint of sorcerers. So I'm standing there. I said, oh, let me just kind of like focus on Saint Cyprian. And then things started spinning around. And I gave them to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he started walking around the hotel room. Nothing went on. And he walked out and he walked around. And then all of a sudden he goes to the desk. And there's Saint Cyprian. And he points points these copper divining rods there, and they start spinning around. And I looked at his hands. He wasn't messing around with anything. So I guess, Steve, what I'll say is, as a man that has been formally trained in quantitative measures, you know, it's great that you're finding these things, but I believe, like the yin and the yang, there are two different ways to approach paranormal investigation. One is quantitative in reading electromagnetic fields and everything, but I believe another one has to do with psychics and mediums and divining rods, and I believe that they're both important. And I think that's what you 100%. Said. And my experience this weekend with St. Cyprian, that little statue of St. Cyprian that spun the divining rods around. I mean, nothing like that. I've never seen anything like that. A little porcelain statue of St. Cyprian activated these divining rods like you wouldn't believe. So it's mm-hmm. interesting. I guess I've had to learn, I guess practically speaking, I've had to learn how to investigate differently than using data. And it's like when you get, I'll say this and then I'll shut up. It's like when you get a remote viewer, like Robin McRae, who's normally with us, she's very sick tonight. But it's like when you get a remote viewer and they tell you the same thing that comes from research articles, and they don't know what you're going to ask them to do. It's amazing. And in fact, Trey was on the show when she came. Devin, you there?
I am, yep.
That's right. Your friend that had passed away, you and your people went in and took things that let you remember your friend, correct?
Yes, uh-huh.
And then Robin is on the show trying to contact your friend who had passed away, and all of a sudden she says, blue ribbon, blue ribbon, all I see is blue ribbons. And she went on about it for about 3 minutes. And so after the show, Devin goes into his closet and goes through the things that he collected from this nice lady who was his friend that passed away, and he finds a shirt that is a Pabst Blue Ribbon shirt that has it has blue ribbons all over it. And Robin picked it up, and I believe that data from remote viewers, data from psychics, data from mediums is as admissible as data from electronic means. And again, what you said was kind of music to my ears. I wanted to state this on Scarycast. This is very important to me to say this. But I'm glad that you said that you don't discount any data. And I think that's important. Now I'll turn it back over to you. I'm sorry, but I just got excited. I had to say this. Is that okay?
No, all right. And I agree. I think, you know, like I said, for years we focused really on the scientific side of things. And it wasn't until we started expanding our approach that we started hitting on some really important pieces, especially at the Hanover Tavern. The lady in black, the reason that we have finally been able to come in contact with her for, you know, after so many years, I couldn't tell you exactly, but I think a big part of it is getting the right people in there and also connecting with her on a psychic level as opposed to light up these lights or change that or knock on the door or whatever. And there are a lot of teams that are still in that spot where they only rely on science or they only rely on metaphysics. And I think there's a lot to learn when you are able to apply both and correlate your findings between the two. You know, a lot of people think that you can't have science when you're utilizing psychics. And I would disagree because I think that you could, even making a journal of the experiences that somebody is having as a remote viewer and somebody is having in a paranormal or a haunted location, and then reviewing them over time. I mean, there's a study that my team is going to be building out right now that directly aligns with times of year and times of historical occurrences or events at a location. And how do we align that and study that from a psychic level, seeing if we get more experiences with our psychics on our team during a specific time of year, during a specific event, or that sort of thing. So I think that you need to have both pieces to solve this puzzle. I don't think it's one that is purely science. I don't think it's something that's purely metaphysical. I think it's a healthy mix and things that, you know, need to be taken into consideration when you are investigating.
Cool. I've got a question for you, Steve.
I want to make one statement. I love the way you put it. It's metaphysical and scientific. And that is the yin and the yang of what you and I and everybody else that goes out there to hunt ghosts, that's what we need. We need the yin and the yang. We need the touchy-feely, what people call woo, and that pisses me off. We need that. And then we also need science, because the two together give us, I believe, the correct picture. And by the way, I will have my divining rods up there. Just wanted you to know that, okay?
I've seen some really cool stuff with divining rods. One of my favorites, my friends at Spirit Guides Paranormal, they use divining rods for a good chunk of their investigating, and they do something called dueling rods. And they have two different people. Typically, it's going to be like a guest on an investigation and one of their team members. They will stand side by side and ask a question. And it's really neat when you can record an EVP and get like a hit of a spike in electromagnetic energy, but you also see both divining rods turning the same direction at the very same time. So stuff like that is pretty wild. It's to me, you know, that's
heck,
not like something
yes,
chased me down
heck
a hallway,
yes, it
but
isn't.
It's cool.
Heck yes, it is. St. Cyprian. You know, spinning our divining rods, and that's the only place in that hotel room that it was happening. Well, look, Mark Johnston has a question. Mark, I'm sorry, I've had too much. Steve, we're going to have you back. And by the way, thanks to everybody, WLSC AM and FM, Loris, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We're glad you're here with us on your Saturday night overnight. We've got Steve Dills of the Hanover Tavern in Virginia, and they've got great things, great paranormal things happening. Mark Johnston, you have the floor.
Well, first of all, I'm finding this conversation really interesting. And I'm looking at pictures of this tavern right now. It's a beautiful building. Reminds me a lot of where I live in Niagara on the Lake, which was the site of the War of 1812. I imagine it's around the same time period as that. But my question has to do with EVP phenomenon. Is that how it's called? The voice where you're recording voice. I want to know what types of voice recordings have you had, and is there anywhere where we can see some of the footage or any type of investigations? Like, is there any sites or anywhere where I can check that out after the show?
Yeah, sure. So all of, you know, most of what we have online is on our website, which is transcendparanormal.com. We do have a YouTube, and it's just YouTube. I think it's YouTube/ Transcend Paranormal. We don't post too many videos out there of our experiences. There tends to be a lot of pushback when you post something and you say, hey, check out this EVP, and then inevitably somebody replies, well, you faked it. And it's hard because if they're not there, then obviously you can't really prove that. So we don't post as much as we used to. However, we do have a video up there from one of my favorite locations, St. Albans Sanatorium in Radford, Virginia. And that has some of the coolest EVPs that we've ever recorded. We've got an EVP from the main stairwell of a woman singing. And for the life of me, I have not been able to match her lyrics with an actual song. So I don't know if this is something that she came up with and decided to sing or what. And we've got some others that are fairly controversial in terms of if you know the stories of some of the patients at St. Albans Sanatorium and their involvement or lack of involvement with something that went on there that was pretty morbid. We have some EVPs that directly, like Class A, which is like your very clearest of audio recordings, EVPs directly talking about that, which is really, really cool. And those are on YouTube. In terms of recordings, you know, a lot of it is voice, but not all of it is. when you think of the paranormal, we tend to be, as humans, fairly selfish creatures in terms of what we think is going on. We tend to like to focus on the idea that ghosts or spirits are human and that we are the only ones that can be ghosts. If you, you know, pertain to the idea that ghosts are the spirits of folks that have passed on, if that's your definition of a ghost, why does it have to be a human? I will tell you, we have recorded the sounds of cats, goats. I have recorded a horse neighing at me at places where there were definitely no horses because I would have seen a horse. of course, I had to add that. We've recorded one of the coolest EVPs from a place called, I talked about it earlier, but it's Henricus Historical Park. It was the second English settlement in America. It was founded in, John, I'm so sorry, one of my team members. I want to say it was early 1600s, 1601, somewhere in there, 1610 maybe, 1609. When these folks came up the river from Jamestown, because Jamestown over time became a fairly deadly place to live. It was not very clean, and there were a fair amount of Native American raids on Jamestown. And so this group of folks moved upriver, boarded a ship, found a peninsula, and they said, we're going to set up a home there. And they founded the city of Henricus. We've gone and investigated here many, many times. And one of the cool things is that for a period, a short period, but a period, the Native Americans in the area known as the Powhatan and the English settlers lived side by side fairly well. And so you had Native Americans interacting and trading with the early English settlers. We're investigating one night in one of the buildings, and we record this girl talking and interacting with us when we said, hey, is anybody here? We hear somebody say something, and we have no idea what it is. It was like just straight gobbledygook, right? And so luckily we had some of the staff that decided they were interested in seeing what we were doing. We share it with them, and we were able to translate this EVP into English from Algonquin, Virginia Algonquin, which is a dialect that the Native American tribes, the Powhatan tribe, which was in the area, spoke. And we have this young girl where we're walking into one of these buildings and we're saying, hey, is anybody here? You want to come and hang with us? There is a young girl reply saying, hello, friend, in Algonquin. And that is one of two EVPs in Algonquin that we've recorded there at Henricus. And that was so cool. Like, to record in something that, you know, is 200-plus years ago of this now dead language, Virginia Algonquin is extinct, was phenomenal.
Yeah, I can tell you, this is Dr. John, I can tell you that when you go to Alice Flagg's gravesite and you get some kind of garbled messages and you slow it down and it says, say hello to me. And only you and the head of the Kentucky Ghost Hunters are there. And neither one of you said it. And a young girl's voice says, say hello to me. That is terrifying, don't you think?
I think it's neat. I mean,
It just says there's someone out there. There's something out there, and we don't need to discount it. And mm-hmm. I had that experience. That was the night before my doctoral dissertation defense. And I'm out in a graveyard at 3 in the morning having to leave at NC State. No, I'm serious. It's 3 in the morning, and I'm out there. And then all of a sudden we get back to the house, and he's got all of his equipment set up. And by 4 in the morning, he's banging on my door. John, you got to hear this. John, you got to hear this. It's like, oh, my God. You know, this is my doctoral dissertation day. Come on. But he was right. It was like the most amazing thing I ever heard. Oh, and then she said, talk to me. And that was, oh, that was even more terrifying. So what I'm saying is it's just, it's amazing what is out there. And I don't respect scientists that discount, that just automatically discount this stuff because there's too much evidence. There's way too much. You guys have got tons of evidence, correct, Steve?
Oh, I mean, yeah. We've got it. You know, I always have a tough time when people say like of ghosts, right? Because I myself could not define what a ghost is. But I have evidence of preternatural phenomena that is occurring that currently is not understood in our understanding of physics, laws of reality.
Right, and that's wonderful. Well, Mark, thank you. Now, Mark, do you have any more to your question or more questions to ask Steve?
Just more of a statement that, like, I've always wondered the same thing, what he was just saying, like, it's kind of, like, unexplained in our physical terms of reality. And I was wondering if, like, there's some way that, like, we spiritual energies recorded in a certain location, because it always has to do with, like, a location, right? And things are record. We can record things to tapes. We can record things to records and video cameras. I'm wondering if, like, somehow, like, spiritual energy from a person, especially if something really emotionally horrible or, like, you know, death or whatever happened there, that is this energy imprinted on our environment somehow? But then it's interesting how sometimes it seems to kind of respond to us, like, in question form. And so it seems like there's some kind of interacting energy there, and that's always what has fascinated me about this type of phenomenon. And hopefully someday I'd love to come down. Maybe, John, we can meet there. It's kind of halfway in between me and you. Maybe we can meet there for a paranormal exploration sometime.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah, absolutely. I'm sure if we give Steve enough notification, we could meet with him and we could figure out what's going on. We could figure out something interesting to do. Does that sound good, Steve?
Yeah, certainly. And like you said, you know, there is a popular theory of stone tape theory where the events that we undergo is imprinted in the location or the walls or the ground or the trees or the rocks that are around us. Now, one would think that if it's a recording, it is something that is more residual, right? It's not going to interact with you. You know, the same thing is going to occur at the same time of the same day of the same month of the same year, or, you know, every year or whatever, right? And I think that occurs in some places, whether it's because it's pertaining specifically to stone tape theory, I don't know. But I have had some really, really weird things where I've seen, for example, I'll call it a creature that has materialized from a room that was empty, walked out of the room on all fours. It was walking like a cat, but it was definitely human-shaped, humanoid, and then turn and dart down a hallway that pretty much dead ends. Three people in that room saw that, and we chased after it. It occurred, I mean, we were in there for 45 minutes, and for whatever reason, this thing decided after we played and Johnny Cash that, I don't know if it was coincidence, that it was immediately after we finished playing two songs, but immediately after we finished, this thing comes out of this room and jolts down the hallway. You know, it's the same place that we've had. For example, the last time I was up there, I read the Jungle Book in one of the rooms where it's reported that there are spirits of children or something that appears to be younger. And I had a data logger. I could visually see it, right? I could see some of the, you know, the data coming off of it. And I was like, hey, listen, I'm going to read the Jungle Book. If you want me to, I need you to get that number, that EMF number, up to, let's just say, 10. I can't remember what the number was. But I had it spiked to 10. So I started reading a page, and then I said, hey, I need to know you're still listening to me. So if you're still listening, spike it to 10 again. I read that entire book page by page, where every time I finished a page, I had it spiked back up to 10 on request. So to me, that's something that's more intelligent, right? It wouldn't just hit that, you know, like, okay, every 10 minutes, you know, this residual energy is going to do this thing. So it's quite interesting because run into different things.
And you know, Steve, I want to make a comment. That does pass the Turing test for artificial intelligence because Alan Turing developed a test. He said, if you can't tell if something's a machine answer or not, then it exhibits intelligence. That is still, to this day, the thing that we use to determine if something is intelligent, whether it's a machine or whatever. And that absolutely,
yeah, for AI,
when you ask it to spike and it spikes, that has exhibited intelligence in the most scientific manner possible. And I guess you might not know about the Turing test, and I'd be glad to share that with you. I've always wanted to put together a short paper about the paranormal investigations and the Turing test, because that is such a famous thing. So, but we'll talk about that later. How's that?
Yeah, definitely. I know about the Turing test for sure. I love AI, and part of my job, I deal with AI and all that sort of fun stuff. So,
right. Well, I'm glad you do, and I appreciate you knowing that. Now, Devin, do you have a question for Steve?
Well, I was very intrigued when you mentioned the library there near the tavern, and you alluded to it possibly being built over a burial ground. I wondered if that was because of any ghost hunting that you've done there, or how did you determine that? It sounds like there must be a good story behind that.
Yeah, so we actually we've investigated the library a number of times. We've recorded some fairly good activity in there. A lot of what we have interacted in there seems to be residual. The interesting thing is it wasn't always just a library. It has always been a library, but at one point in the basement of the building was actually a 911 dispatch center. So, you know, it kind of falls into one of my own ideas or theories on why some of these activities have heightened or just paranormal phenomena ongoing at the location is because of energy in the form of emotion that we as living, breathing creatures have kind of put off in that environment. Doesn't have to be bad. I know a lot of people like to tie like paranormal activity to Gettysburg because there was massive amount of casualties, right? But I've also had activity in family homes, and it was, you know, happy things. You know, walking in and hearing the sound of a piano playing Christmas music, Christmas tunes, right? That's definitely not somebody that's, like, distraught and dead. In the library, I think because of all that pent-up energy and emotion from being a 911 dispatcher, like, my wife was a 911 dispatcher for a little bit, and it takes quite a toll on you, listening to some of those calls, especially some of the worst ones coming in. So we have recorded some activity in there. However, the reason that we know it was built either on or immediately next to a graveyard is because when they were actually doing a little bit of construction on the back side of the building, they were going to, I want to say they were trying to put in a parking lot, They started doing some digging, and lo and behold, they started pulling up some bodies. At that point, they realized, hey, this is probably a burial ground for the tavern, which it was. It actually fits, like, historically, if you look at a lot of these older buildings, especially, like, taverns, plantations, those sorts of things, you wouldn't bury your family immediately up against your house. It would be fairly within eye shot, but at some distance. And so they started digging, and they realized that they were pulling up bodies, and they had to stop doing construction. And so they put down a very tiny placard, but it's called the Tillman Burial Ground, and it is a nod to the Tillman family that owned and operated the tavern for a period of time. It is more than likely that some of the Tillman family is buried there. I'm not sure if they exhumed or if they left, but it is still a burial ground today. And so I constantly wonder if the original library is built upon graves, because it's literally, like, right up against the building is right where they found remains.
Now, this is Dr. John. I've got a quick question. You mentioned the Tillman family. They were notorious in South Carolina. Pitchfork Van Tillman was, you can tell, Pitchfork Van Tillman. He was one hell of a guy. He was actually instrumental in funding a lot of Clemson University, and they have Tillman Hall there, or we have Tillman. You know, it's funny, if it's Clemson, we say we. But it is haunted. It is haunted with Pitchfork Van's ghost. And do you think there's any relationship between the Tillmans of South Carolina and the Tillmans of Virginia? That would be, because I've got some research, and that would provide a very convenient, a convenient way to talk about both families at the same time. So I'm sorry, you said maybe?
It's possible. It's hard to say. I've not done a lot of genealogical research on the Tillman family. I know that the Tillman family owned the tavern for several generations, starting in 1764. And I want to say the last Tillman ended up turning it over in 1929. There was a small gap where I think it was not owned by them, but it was inherited back into the family. Looking back, 1764 to 1829 is essentially when they owned and operated the tavern. So it would either be before that they moved up, or maybe family stopped at Hanover County and some just kept going.
Right, so that's another question for another time, don't you think?
Oh, I agree. We'd have to do some digging.
And you know what? The more we talk, the more questions we have. Devin, thank you for that question. It generated a lot of information, answers, and questions. So I want to say, because we have 2 minutes left, and it has been wonderful to have you here. And absolutely, would you come back?
Oh yeah, definitely. Love to.
Well, good. Well, we've had a great. I'll speak for everyone here, all the hosts, and we've had a great time with you. It's been wonderful. And there's the British ladies telling me it's 90 seconds. So I wanted to say thank you very much, everybody. So give us the real quick pitch for the weekend of the 21st and the 22nd.
Sure, yeah, so come on and join us January 21st and 22nd for the first inaugural Hanover Tavern Paracon. We're going to have a great lineup of speakers and guests and vendors. We're going to do some investigating. We're going to have some great food. And the best part is 100% of the proceeds go directly towards the historical preservation renovations for the Hanover Tavern, as well as the educational outreach that the Hanover Tavern provides into the community.
All right, that's great. And everybody, please watch Scarycast. We're going to try to provide some great coverage of this event. Thanks a lot to our guest, Stephen Dills. Thanks to our co-hosts, Dr. Trey Donaway, Devin Tate, and Mark Johnson. Our lovely lady, the Queen of Scary Cast, Robin McRae, is out on sick leave tonight. We hope she feels better. Thanks a lot to everybody. We'll see you next week with John LeMay. He is back. Yes, he is back. Absolutely. The great John LeMay, the author, is back on the one and only Scary Cast. Be careful out there. It's cold. Goodbye, Steve.
Good night.
Good night.
See you guys. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.
Have a good one. Well, there we go. We can end the episode. Thanks a lot.